and welcome to The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple. We are now into the third season of The Thriller Zone, and I could not be happier. Why? Well, we started this, as you know, just over a year ago. Very first guest was May Cobb. We have grown incrementally over the weeks and months to becoming one of the faster growing podcasts in the world. And I am so pleased with that. I'm so excited. You know why? This is my absolute first love. I love to write books. I love to read books. But boy, there is nothing like podcasting to me because it brings back the old feelings of being on the radio, which I wanted to do when I was probably 10 years old. And by the time I was 16, I had my very first radio show and went on to conquer quite a prolific career in radio. So coming back around 20 years later and starting a podcast, it is kind of a culmination of a dream come true. And on top of that, I get to interview some of the coolest, most talented people in the world. And today is no different. Why? Dean Koontz is on the show today. Yeah, I'm a little nervous. A guy who writes prolific amount of work. And this particular book by Dean Koontz, The Big Dark Sky, this is a thriller. It's a suspense. It's intriguing. It's mystical. It's magical. It's scientific. Well, I'm not going to go into too much depth, but I'm going to tell you The Big Dark Sky is amazing. And guess what? You get a chance to win a copy. You see here over the shoulder? Yeah, behind me, I got three copies that I would love to give to a loyal, faithful, happy listener. And at the end of the show, I'm going to tell you exactly how you can win a hard copy cover of
The Big Dark Sky.
You're going to have to stick around for the end of the show. And I can tell you, this is among the top favorite shows that I've had yet. Okay, there's my geek statement. Pretty amazing. Guy is as delightful as they come. Please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Thriller Zone, Dean Koontz.
Hello.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm so good, Dean. How are you, sir?
Well, I have a little laryngitis, but I think I'll get through this.
Well, we're both suffering something. 15 minutes ago, I got a phone call from my wife who was out taking an early morning run, and she took a wicked fall. So I'm like, I'll be right there, and got her home, and she's all bandaged up. And I'm like, I got to get on a call.
Well, the wife comes first, certainly ahead of me.
That is true. And I'll tell you what, that makes me think, is it 47, 48? How many years you've been with Gerda?
We've been married, it'd be 56 years in October. Yeah. In California, that's unheard of.
That's up in miracle territory, right?
Yes, it is. Yes. And especially considering that she's married to me, it's miraculous that she stayed connected. So.
Yeah, but if what I've read is true, you guys were young sweethearts. I think I saw a photograph or a video where you met in grade school?
Well, it was actually before that. I was probably 4 and she was probably 3. And I didn't know this when I asked her to marry me, which was when I was in college and she was a senior. And my mother told me, oh, you met many years ago when you were very small. And she had a picture from this birthday party. And it just so happens that among the 20-some kids around this big table standing and sitting, Gerda and I are sitting directly across from each other. And I often say when I show that photo, that's me sitting there with a big smile on my face because I see my future. That's her with a frown on her face because she sees hers.
That's funny. But listen, longevity, like you said, it's a miracle. It's a miracle anywhere these days. But yeah, California, for some reason, just. All right. Well, this is a sincere pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the Thriller Zone podcast. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope I'm coherent. Let's see.
We'll do our best. I do. I want to tell you front. First of all, I am going to try my best not to appear as a supreme geek, although I cannot promise you that's not going to happen.
Okay. Well, I'll steal myself.
Now, quick note on the behind you that, because I love, again, I think it was the same. I think it was a CBS morning special. And I got to see your office where you have all your books lined up in your desk. And, you know, because I'm an author myself and I was geeking out on this. This background looks like a different one than that.
Yes, we're building another house and we weren't going to sell the one that was in the interview you're mentioning until we finished building, but then we had an offer we couldn't refuse. It involved no horse's head. And we took it, and then we needed an interim house. So here we are in the interim house, and this is my assistant's office, which it turns out to work pretty well. The books are real behind me. They're not, you know, cardboard. We actually don't have enough room for all the books, so we never have to fake them with a fake background.
Yeah. Now, referring to that same house, Dean, that was a spectacular home. And it's, I want to say, Newport Beach, Laguna area, up in just the most beautiful area of that whole town. Are you going to be able to stay in the same neighborhood?
We moved to the community right next door, which is Irvine, into a little community that's it's more rustic. It's a new community. It's about 15 years old, I guess, or something. But houses are actually a pretty good rendition of Tuscan. That's the building standards. Although the one we're working on has an Art Deco flair about it. So it's a little more out there. We have deer in the streets. We have coyotes. That's kind of interesting. We're 10 to 15 minutes from the other house, going from Newport Beach to deer in the streets, which is there's few places in the world other than California where these opposites collide everywhere you look.
That is crazy. We were just, wife and I were just up in Lake Tahoe this weekend, and black bears were everywhere, and we'd spot them every once in a while, and it was almost as commonplace as tourists. And I was like, all right, how weird is this to go from San Diego to, you know, bears and deers and coyotes?
It'll get really weird when you go into the casino and you see a bear playing blackjack. Then you'll know it's gotten really weird.
And if he's singing Elvis songs, then I'm really going to be perplexed.
And he almost surely will.
All right. Well, we're going to be talking about this beautiful book, The Big Dark Sky, with Dean Koontz here in just a couple of minutes. But I do want to, for those who may have been living in a cave or under a rock somewhere, I want to talk a little bit about you, if you'll bear with me. I do want to say it is wicked awesome. But, you know, I can't imagine anyone not knowing who you are. But I'll say that some of these numbers are going to be a little bit off, and I'm sure by the time we get through this podcast, it will have already changed again, but something like no less than 79 New York Times bestsellers, 14 of which were number one. And when you get into 38 languages and approach more than 500,000 copies, you're in an echelon, Dean, that I've never spoken to anyone in that category before, but what has that been like? This career of yours, amazing.
Well, I'll correct one error.
Okay.
It's not 500,000 copies. It's 500,000,000 copies. It's 500 million.
But I'm an idiot. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Well, we're all idiots in this world. That's what's wrong with it. First of all, did I ever see this coming? Oh, no. When I was beginning and I'd sold a couple of paperbacks and some short stories, and my wife said, I know you want to be a writer, not a teacher, so I'll support you for 5 years. If you can't make it in five, I'll never make it. And we sat down and discussed how much I'd have to earn to make this a viable career. And we decided if I could just do $25,000 a year, this was many years ago, it was more money than now, but it wasn't a lot. Then with her job in mind, we could do this. We never saw it coming. And then slowly we did. Long before my publisher saw it coming, I saw it coming in the Mayo volume that started rising. I saw it coming in where we got reviewed and how much more enthusiastic they were. And it was interesting to me that so many of publishers I had worked with never saw it coming, even as it was happening. And I was able to buy back many of the early books I wrote, or acquire them back for no cost. Just they said, here, you can have it, it has no value. And later, those books went on to sell millions of copies in paperback. So, yeah, it took us a while to figure out that this could ever happen. And when it did happen, it's been amazing. I look back on it, I'm so grateful for it, and can't imagine how it grew to what it grew to. But I'm not going to second guess it.
Right.
And I'm still doing it at my age. You know, I'm 246. So I'm still working at it. I don't intend to quit though I fall dead.
Now, I was going to bring this up later, but I'll bring it up now since you brought it. You have one of the most intense work ethics of anyone that I've heard. And this story I was reading, you clock somewhere around 10 hours a day. And I think I heard 6 days a week. You certainly don't still go at it that hard, do you?
Absolutely, I do. There's right now I'm at 7 days a week because I'm into a book that is really gripping me and started out as being just a book I really wanted to write. And now I'm thinking, maybe this is a trilogy. Somebody who's 246 years old should not be thinking about a trilogy. The clock is ticking, but it's now suddenly in my head that might happen. People say, well, you have no time to do anything else. Yes, I sleep about 6 hours a day. And that leaves, 8 hours a day for anything else I want to do. It's hard writing where you are always setting a higher bar for yourself. But on the other hand, you love it. It's also like play. And very few people get to earn a living doing something they consider to be play. So you have to have some gratitude for that.
Sure. And that's what I find so fascinating, Dean, is you have never, and I went back through the whole list, and I'm like, you've never run out of ideas. You've never repeated yourself. And I was at an event a couple of weeks ago, a Thriller Fest up in New York City, and I was talking to a buddy of mine, and I said, you know, people always, a lot of interviewers will use that cliche line that I promised to myself I would never use, and I'm not going to use it here, but it's like, how, where do you get your ideas? And I'm thinking, it's one of the most ridiculous questions ever, because we're writers. We create things out of the air. Of course, it's just news or watching life. But to be able to have this prolific of a career and not repeat yourself and to always keep it fresh is just, that's when you know two things. It's true blue, amazing talent, and it's pure true blue passion.
It is. It's the passion is the part that I often think that if you have the passion for it and the work ethic, the talent is there's got to be some, but it doesn't have to be overwhelming, because persistence and passion make up for a lot of shortcomings otherwise. I used to say sometimes when I would get smartass answers to where you get your ideas. And for a while I said, there's this little shop in Parowan, Utah, where you can buy plot ideas that are amazing. But then I sort of gave that up, and because nobody believed Parowan. It is a town, but it just doesn't seem like a literary town. And this is true, the imagination is like a muscle. The more you use it, the more it delivers to you. And that is what I think. It's because I've never relented and I'm always moving on to something else. There are always new ideas. I've had moments where I thought, especially as I got older, and I thought, I think I'm beginning to run out. And it's funny because that panic sets in and you're finishing a book and you don't know what you're going to do next. And you finish the book, and there's the new idea. Or sometimes here's two or three, and you've got to choose between them. And your subconscious was holding it all in, I think, because you had to focus on one you're finishing. And then as soon as you do, boom, there's the new stuff. But you've always got to be feeding your mind, have interest in the world and all of everything that's going on in it. And that's where the ideas come from. Not that you're reading the paper and say, oh, that would make a great novel. It doesn't quite work that way.
Right.
Just feed the subconscious and something down there starts putting bits together.
That's a really great point. To me, it's like a soup. You know, sometimes I was a bachelor a long time before I got married, which was late in life. And I, on many of those nights, I would just throw, oh, let's see what I've got. And I'd throw it in the pot and it would just simmer. And eventually, amazingly, it would be delicious. And it's kind of like that. I have to believe it's the same with you. I mean, you have an idea and you go, let me just put it on the back burner for a second or a week or a month. And then all of a sudden you're over here. And to your point of the subconscious, your subconscious will do that work behind the scenes, won't it, Dean? It'll just grab that thing and go, oh, now I got a connection.
Yeah, it's something you have to consciously manage it once you begin to write. But by the time you've got the idea for what the book is likely to be about, which for me is a premise, not an entire plot. I don't plot ahead of time. It's a premise, an idea, a character or two that I think I'm going to enjoy writing. One of them will be the lead. One will probably be the antagonist. Where it'll be two great leads and I'll figure out the antagonist. But that's all I need. Plus, what is the book about other than the story? What does it say about, I don't like to put it this way, it sounds too college writing course, but what about the human condition does this book find interesting? That's all I need to get going. And then you've put all this together in a way in the subconscious, but then when you start to write, you know, you've got to bring the conscious mind into it and you've got to figure out, okay, where does this go? And that is, that's the scary part and the exhilarating part, because it often goes, when you don't plot ahead, as I don't, it often goes places you never imagined. And that becomes very exciting to me because it means you could fall on your face or you could succeed in a way you didn't anticipate. And both of those are interesting.
Okay, now that blows my mind, although I do have a note to mention later about the plotter, pantser, whether you like those terms or not. Some people love to do exhaustive outlines like Jeffrey Deaver. I think we've shared that same insight. And others like to just sit down and go with it. So are you telling me, Dean, that you literally go, okay, it's a Big Dark Sky. It's about this thing that's happening here. And there's this person here I really want to talk about. And then you just go from there literally for those 400 plus pages.
Absolutely. by the way, I'm not a plotter. And I always wear pants. So I don't know if the term pantser is. So I'm not sure that fits me. But yeah, the first book I ever did that with was the first book I had that became a hardcover bestseller. It was a novel called Strangers. And it had a large cast of characters. It was, the manuscript was well over a quarter of a million words, 900 and some manuscript pages. And I just began with concept in the first couple of characters and let it evolve. And I had more fun with that than I'd ever had with the novel previously. And as I said, it was the first hardcover bestseller I had. And after that, I thought, wow, this works. Why go back to the other? One of the problems I always ran into when I plotted, and in those days, because I was a solid mid-list writer at that time, I could sell a book based on an outline. So I would do an outline, 10 pages, send it in, they buy the book, they pay me half, I write the book, they get the other half. And the problem that was driving me insane was I would never fully follow the outline. I'd start, then the novel would go somewhere better and I'd deliver it. And though it had gone somewhere better, the editor and publisher would say, this isn't the book we bought. And they would get hung up on what it wasn't rather than what it was. And finally, in frustration, that's why I stopped writing outlines or letting it even see more. I don't even tell a publisher what a book's about in advance of delivering the manuscript. They just have confidence that it'll probably work.
Right.
And it's, and so far it has.
Well, and you have had the track record that would allow that to happen. This would not have happened a dozen years before that. But the thing about strangers, and I had this as a note later, what do you suppose was the magic about that, part A? And part B is, if you had started out with that long of a book, we all know that a publisher would probably go, okay, Dean, this is like way too long. You got to cut this thing down. So...
that's exactly what happened with Strangers. They gave me, the editor, the publisher came back. She was also my editor at the time. And she said, I'm going to assign you a literary editor because the quality of your prose deserves that. Now, I knew this person. I think she was a very bright publisher, but she only did one kind of thing. And it was those writers who write pretty much the same book again and again. Sometimes I love those writers. Dick Francis was one of them. I knew as soon as she was going to bring in an editor, she was thinking, okay, I can't handle him. He won't listen to what I'm telling him, so somebody else has to edit him. And she gave him the task of getting this 940-page manuscript down to no more than 600 pages. And I couldn't see how to do anything to cut it. And he was a wonderful editor. He was a very sweet man. He had come from Viking. She had hired him from Viking to come and do certain books. And he kept the manuscript for 6 weeks. He told me he was going to show me how to cut 300 pages minimum. So he kept it for 6 weeks, and when he sent it to me, it came with the note, said, "Dear Dean, you'll see what I've redlined for cutting. I have redlined 10 pages worth of cuts. Now you just apply my technique and find the other 290. And he was joking.
Right.
But you never know. And so I called him and said, "This is a joke, right? You can't find any more to cut." And he said, "No." He said, "You know, we're very disappointed." And he was serious about this, which itself is very funny. He says, "This book has so many characters with so many deep stories to each of them that what we were hoping is we could just cut out three of these characters and that would bring the book down 300 pages. But we've realized that if you cut any one of these characters, the entire novel falls apart." And I said, "Well, in the future, I will always write three characters that we can rip out with no effect on them." But it struck me as so strange that they would think that was even possible. But
Yeah, like Jenga, like you could pull out this and this piece over here and it wouldn't affect the whole thing falling.
The whole tower would still stand. Yeah.
That is crazy. It's on your website and it's a couple of other places that you won Atlantic Monthly's fiction competition back as a senior in college and that you've never stopped writing since, which in and of itself is pretty amazing. But my question is, did you say to yourself when you won that award, "Yep, you know what? This right here is exactly what I'm going to do with my life." I mean, was it that... instill that much of resounding confidence in you at that moment?
I worked on the campus literary magazine, or so it was called. And this story had appeared in it. And it had been written for another professor in a short story class. I didn't submit it. The woman who was in charge of the literary magazine submitted it without my knowledge. So when it won, this was a small college in Pennsylvania in the state college system, and professors had been submitting stuff to this competition for decades, and nobody had ever won anything. So all that mattered to me for a while was that when I got this award, which I hadn't even known it was submitted for, I suddenly went from the slacker of the year in college to a guy who couldn't do wrong in any of his English classes. I got A's whether I worked or not. And I thought, this is perfect. Because I was basically a slacker in the education system. So being able to get A's simply for some story you've done that was fun to do struck me. I think it took me a little while to think, the first thing I thought was, wow, you can do this and people be fooled into thinking it has value. And then there was no money associated with this award. It was a certificate, and they published a little booklet with stories in it. And then there was a magazine, I think it was called Readers and Writers. And I submitted it to Readers and Writers on my own, and they bought it. And I was paid $50. Doesn't sound much, but when you're a senior in college, and paperbacks in those days were anywhere from 45 to 60 cents, I could buy a slew of paperbacks with $50. So it was a big deal to me. Yeah. And it was then I started to think, I was so slow about some things. I hadn't realized you could actually make a living as a writer. I thought it's something somebody did while they taught in college or were on some stipend that somebody was paying them. And when I realized, no, there's people who do this for a living, I think then, sort of retroactively to the award, it was, okay, maybe I'd like to do this. And that's when I started applying myself.
Wow. That's just, I love that. You know, I mentioned this a second ago. We were talking about your work ethic and the amount of hours that you write. And I was going to say, I'd love to know, in your spare time, if you have any, you have very little spare time, is there someone that you read that you really enjoy that you, that's maybe completely different or even nonfiction from what you ordinarily are?
A lot of books I've been writing require a lot of research. So a lot of pleasure reading is in nonfiction because it's also work research. Right. And lately I've been going back to read people that I loved when I was in my 20s and 30s, which is 210 years ago or so. And I wanted to see whether those people who really inspired me, I still felt that way about them. And it's a little, you know, I feel a little jeopardy about doing this. Because some writers like John D. MacDonald had enormous influence on me. John D. MacDonald taught me that you could stop the action of a novel for several pages and do character backgrounds so interesting that the reader was compelled through it just as he was in an action scene. And when I first discovered John D. MacDonald, I read 33 novels in 30 days, I think it was. I did nothing else but read John D. MacDonald in sleep. And so he had a profound effect on me. And I went back to him and Ray Bradbury and a number of writers who had a lot of effect on me. And I've been reading them. And I have found 2 or 1, they still resonate with me. And that's very heartening. There's a few others I might be a little slower to go back and read. But that's sort of what I've been reading lately. And so I haven't gone on to a lot of new stuff, though I keep piling up on the nightstand and I will get to it.
I bet it's quite a stack. And I was going to ask, and you're too much of a gentleman to throw anybody under the bus. I have to know that about you, but have you run across someone that you go, oh, I used to read them. And then you go back and you read it and they're still writing and you go, wow, you're phoning it in or you're repeating yourself or anything like that.
Yeah, there have been a couple of those. Yeah. I won't mention names, right. Even though one of them has passed away. There was a writer, I won't use his name, that I adored. I was buying his hardcovers when I couldn't afford hardcovers. And when hardcovers were $4.95 and $5.95. He was just unique. And he didn't hit big time until he was in his 50s. And it must have been very frustrating. He wrote films as well, but he wrote a lot of excellent novels in a couple of different genres. And suddenly, all the literati found him. And he began to get praise through the roof, and he was everybody's darling. And I noticed that the first thing, I was so happy for him. It was like, great, finally people are noticing. And then after a while, I began to notice they weren't praising the complete panoply of qualities in his novels. they were focused on like two of five great things he did. And I'm just picking those numbers out of the air. And then I noticed as the years went by, his work began to change. And what he was doing was focusing on those things that got all the praise and letting those other qualities sort of fade into the background. And ultimately, I found the later work unreadable. And that, to me, was quite a lesson. I thought, you know, you always have to stay true to what you think you're doing and don't let anyone else tell you what you're doing. And certainly don't let praise overwhelm you, because I tell young writers to get upset when they get a really nasty review and they're in the doldrums and thinking about, you know, strychnine and that sort of thing. And I just say, you can't pay attention to either praise or damnation, because either one is likely to be wrong-headed. You have to thank the people who find quality in it and just say to the others, everyone deserves their opinion, even idiots like you.
It also makes me think about people who have this idea about writing to market. Oh, hey, listen, this is really cool right now, so I'm going to write for that. Well, what happens when you spend 6, 9, 12, 15 months writing to that, and all of a sudden, like everyone's attention span, the tide shifts and you're left out on the other side?
That's the other mistake. I've always said, don't scope the market. Don't go out there and look around for what everybody wants and then write it. What is it that makes you want to be a writer? What is it as a reader that excites you? That's what you want to be writing. And even if the market for it is minuscule, at some point it'll change. And if you're doing the work at the highest level you possibly can, you might be one of those writers who changes the market, and then it's your market. That's the only one that's lasting. Going out writing zombie novels worked for some people for a while because there were hundreds of zombie novels. But most of those writers you can't find anymore. And there's a peril in writing to what the market thinks it wants.
Yeah. And here's another one of those questions. And if it is a cliche, I want you to reach through the camera and just slap me in the face. But I'm going to ask it anyway, because I'm curious. You're one of those few authors that I've followed that had a bevy of pen names. And I wanted to ask, why did you choose that? And what may be the pros and cons of that? So again, if it is one of those, where do you get your ideas? Feel free to just go, bam.
No, we'll have to have coffee and then I'll get you. But unless you're bigger than me, then no, you're safe. But that happened only because I had agents early on they followed that idea that publishers sold to them. If a writer wrote this and there's any audience at all for it, then he has to keep writing that. Very much the same kind of thing over and over. Well, even from the earliest days, once I left the science fiction field, I wasn't doing that. And it led to a lot of frustration with agents. My first one was a crook. My second one was a great guy and an honest man. But I kept giving him outlines for novels. Can you sell this? And he kept bouncing them back to me. He would sell some things, but he would say, you're trying to break out to a large audience. You'll never do that. You're going to be for all your life a very successful mid-list writer, but your vocabulary is too big. Your ideas are too complex, blah, 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 for you to be a bestseller. And I finally had to say, I love you as a human being, but I'm 20 some years old. I can't say this is the rest of my life. And then when I was writing each different thing, the idea was, publishers and agents alike would say, okay, you can't publish this under your name because it isn't what people expect from you. And I bought into that for a while. I would create a pen name for that kind of book. Sometimes it turned out to be one book. Other times, two or three, or in the case of Lee Nichols, I think it was five. Finally, as my novels started to sell under my own name, my wife and I managed to buy back or otherwise reacquire almost all those novels. And as it turned out, when I republished many of them under my name, they were just as popular with the readers. There was an editor who gave me back five novels when I offered to pay to get them back, which I had done in other cases, who said, no, no, you could just have these. They aren't worth anything anyway. He was sort of a smarty human being. And took them back. And the very first one, 2 years later, that I issued, went to number one on the New York Times paperback list. And in the first year, sold 2 million paperbacks. So all of that IP, intellectual property, had value. But it was being spread out under all these pen names,
yeah,
simply because nobody could conceive that one audience would like all these different approaches.
And that is such an excellent point. And I've always thought back to the same line of thinking, oh, where do you get your ideas? But that's it's what a writer does. So, you know, there's this thinking that, oh, well, you can't write suspense and thriller and sci-fi. I mean, you know, your readers are going to get confused. I'm like, said who? Now, I understand if you're writing a systematic series, it's John Smith and you got 12 books and those readers only want to read Dean Koontz's John Smith. Okay, I get that. However, your imagination is so broad and so monumental that it would be ridiculous to try to put you into a box. I mean, that's just bad thinking.
Well, it's bad thinking I've dealt with for a long time. I remember when I delivered the first Odd Thomas, my publisher at that time hated it so much, he wouldn't talk to me about it. Conveyed through my editor that this was a disaster, going to ruin the career. And I'd heard this before, so I didn't take it to heart too much. And then when booksellers started responding to the book and ordering it in greater volume, and the early reviews came out, and I think we had 120 or 30 reviews of that, only two were bad. When all that started happening, he was so upset with me on that book. And I had one more book to deliver. And he said, all I want from you is a really scary novel. I don't want a character like Odd Thomas. I don't want this humor. So I thought, okay, I'm going to have to change publishers. I owe them one more novel. So I wrote a very scary novel just to conclude the contract. Meanwhile, Odd Thomas was published and very successfully, and went through probably 18 printings or something. And then he came to me and said, listen, if we do a new contract, I'll never again tell you what to write. And I thought, okay, that's an admission of something. But there were other moments thereafter where I wasn't told what to write, but it was conveyed to me when something I had delivered was a little bit of a disappointment. And you just have to roll with that. I would have never had the career I had if I had stayed writing the same thing. And
good. Wow, good for you. I watched this video over the weekend. For some reason, I went down I was reading about you, and I just went down this rabbit hole, and I ran across Donald Westlake, who I've always admired. And then he was talking about his character, Richard Stark. And then he said that Richard Stark ended up selling more books than Donald Westlake. And he said, I was so angry at Richard Stark because he was selling more books than me when I realized, oh, I created that guy.
Yeah, he had a number of different pseudonyms. And
yeah.
I think he was guided by that same advice that the Richard Stark novels were, with Parker as a character, were just too hard-boiled to satisfy Westlake readers, who largely always expected an element of humor in the novel. And in the end, ultimately, everybody knew that Richard Stark was Donald Westlake, and nobody cared that they read them both. Although I'm not surprised that more people read the Stark books than read Westlake's own.
Yeah,
but he was a singular talent and a fascinating writer.
Yeah, just few like him. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll dig into The Big Dark Sky, a book Kirkus Reviews calls a nonstop actioner with cosmic overtones. Stay with us. Your host, David Temple here. Hey, before we get back to the show, I thought I would throw in this one quick note. I have had authors approach me who want to actually advertise on the show. And I'm like, that's cool. I love that idea. I mean, think about it. We feature the best thriller writers in the world. You're one of the new up-and-coming thriller writers in the world to be. And you have a book coming out. Our rates are super reasonable. We're easy to work with, as you know, and we all want to work together to make success for all of us. Just reach out to us here at The Thriller Zone at thethrillerzone@gmail.com. Let's talk rates. Let's talk details. Let's do something together in the new year. I think you'll like it. Now, back to the show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dean Koontz, author of The Big Dark Sky, and you're listening to The Thriller Zone with David Temple.
Let's get to The Big Dark Sky, which everyone who watches and listens to this show knows how much I love covers. And I love this cover. It's one of those, it just grabs you at the beginning and it doesn't let go. And Dean, I don't always do this. I wonder, and I'm trying to be really respectful and get in and out because I know you're a busy man, but can I read just one tiny little excerpt for my listeners?
Sure. And this is a great voice, so well, I'm sure you will.
It's just, I go through and I highlight things that I really, really like, and then I'll go back and reread them and I'll just chew on them like a sandwich. And this is one of those. After a week, when the dreams failed to relent, animals began to populate them. Great flocks of rock doves winging through the conifers in the last orange light of day. A herd of elk encircling her as she proceeded with them through a misty dusk. Frequently, a pack of lantern-eyed coyotes swarmed around her under a polished pearl moon, and though the mood was ominous, the threat she sensed did not come from those creatures, but from something unknown in the starlight currents of the deep, cool night. That's one of those, I mean, that is so freaking beautiful and scary. And intriguing, and that's what this book does. It pulls you in, and it puts its arm around you. Then it scares the out of you, and then it. I loved it. Thank you so much for letting me read this.
Years ago I fell in love with the English language, and part of what I love about writing is don't slow the story down necessarily, but give things a chance to breathe. Give us some description that sucks us in. One of the most common things I get in reader mail is that they'll say, when I'm reading your books, it's like I'm watching a movie. I see everything in my head. And that only comes out of, I love Ernest Hemingway, but Hemingway gave up all those writer's tools in order to pare it down to the essence of what basically the themes are. And I say, that's fine. That's well, good. I love that kind of writing, but you're also surrendering most of the things in your toolbox, and there's no reason you should. That isn't the only way to write. So it's what keeps me going. Those different figures of speech, those different descriptions. And the longer you write, more books you have, the harder it is to come up with unique ways to say things. But it's also part of the challenge that makes the writing fun to do.
Well, and you mentioned this earlier in the conversation, you know, you can have the story moving forward at a pretty good clip. And if you stop and you give a little backstory as to a character or take a moment to describe the evening like this, I personally could have gone down that little rabbit hole for quite some time just because it was so eloquent. And I got to admit, and I've got a pretty good education and me talk pretty sometimes, but I got to tell you, I had to pull out a dictionary on once or twice. Five times, but seven. Okay. I'm that's all I'm going to admit.
Okay. You'll tell me the truth in half coffee, but go ahead.
Yeah. But it's just one of those books. And I'll admit that, you know, I have not read your entire library. I've read a couple through the years. And frankly, I think the last one I read, I'm going to be honest with you, it was 2012. And I want to say, I remember it was The Bad Place. I think it was. Yeah. 2010, 12, 13, anywhere in there. And so life got busy on me, Dean, sorry. And I came back around and this came into my view, my spectrum. And I thought, wow, okay. And it's, you know, you can't, I'm going to use a cliche. You can't put it down. You can put it down, but I would advise you not to. But anyway, holy cow. And just when you think it's morphing into one thing, it kind of leads you down the other path. And it actually, Dean, this is my favorite thing. And I'm not going to belabor this point, but you caused me to think about something that I literally, as God is my witness, never thought of, never considered before. And it was an element of your sci-fi. And again, I don't want to say it because I don't want to give anything away, but it, and I'll tell you off camera, I told my wife, I'm like, honey, listen to this. Have you ever had this idea? Dean caused my brain to do this. And I told her, and she looked at me, she goes, I've never had that thought in my life. I'm like, yeah, I'm 63. That has never occurred to me. That's all I'm going to say. Oh,
see, that's what my extra 150 years brings me, is those little insights. But, and I'm always, I look for different ways to tell stories. I have the next book is one called The House at the End of the World. And I found a kind of new way to structure the novel that is really compelling, that plunges you through it and yet allows just what you were quoting there to be unobtrusive. And now I've delivered a second book writing in that vein called After Death. I got a new novel where it came up with something that it's all about, there's so many different ways to tell stories. And that's why I don't want to get locked into them. And I'm always looking for a way that grabs you and propels you. And yet, it isn't just a thriller. I would like to think there's more going on in the book than that. And in fact, I know there is because I think about it pretty deeply. So thank you for reading that. It sounded nice to me.
Well, thank you for that. You know, it's interesting because you do cause that shift in thought. And I don't want to belabor it and I don't want to sound cheesy, but I love thrillers. I love page ripping thrillers. I mean, because I read so much and I've got so many plates in the air, when I want to just escape, that's what I go for. But when you can literally cause me to step outside myself and bend my imagination in a direction that it had not originally bent, that you've accomplished something. But and you just made me think of something. I found trace elements of faith and references to God and heaven in here, which was cool. And I grew up I'm a PK, I grew up a preacher's kid, which tells you some of my dementia. But kidding. There was an intriguing addition to this, suspense sci-fi that I went, wow, there's spirituality in there, which I was not expecting. Where did that come from?
It's something that's been eking into my novels for a long time. I think one of the ones that became really obvious to people was a book called From the Corner of His Eye. And I read a lot of science. It's almost a hobby and has been all my life. And I'm particularly fascinated with quantum mechanics and modern physics. And one day it occurred to me that quantum mechanics, which presents to us a world so intricately connected in all its elements, one thing that most people have heard about it is the butterfly effect.
Oh, yeah. A
flock of butterflies flying in Tokyo affects the weather in Chicago. Or if you do two experiments of the same nature, and you do one in LA and one in New York, and the labs know they're being done together, events in one lab can affect the experiments in another. When you start getting into quantum mechanics, you see a world so strange and so deeply layered that you have to say, okay, there is in the world a spiritual layer. and science is showing it to us. And I've been exploring that for a long time. And I know many scientists, and I get mail from many, and they love that element of it. They will tell you sometimes, I dare not say this among some colleagues, but there's no question to me, and these are very, very high position physicists and astrophysicists and biochemists, and they'll say, it's obvious to me we're living in a created environment. It is not happenstance. Now, that's not saying that any world religion is the correct one or has gotten it all right. It's just saying this is a great mystery. And I began to let that mystery be there in the background of books from the corner of his eye. And it's been something that keeps insisting itself. And the older I get, I've had some strange experiences in life. And I've always been interested in synchronicity, which the big dark sky involves. And synchronicities, there's some examples late in the book that Ganesh Patel, one of the characters, quotes to some of his other characters in the book. And they're real-world synchronicities, so amazing that you think, okay, that's not coincidence. There's something else going on under the surface of things. And I love exploring that book. I had the idea for a book about synchronicity 40 years ago, but I couldn't think how it would enter into the story. And it couldn't be so that the reader would say, well, all of this is just coincidence. No, that wouldn't be the point of the story. The point would be saying, look around you at your life and how many things could have happened so differently and how many things had to come together in a certain way to make this happen. You start to see life in a different way. And that's why I quote Jung in this, who was the creator of the idea of synchronicity. Anyway, that's been an element of books that I don't push at people, but it's more just saying, look at the world in its depth of its wonder. And that makes everything that happens so much more interesting than it otherwise would be.
Yeah, I could talk about quantum mechanics and synchronicity and so many of those elements for hours. I am fascinated by it. I can't get enough of it. When we were at Tahoe this weekend, and you're at, 7,000-8,000 feet, and the air is pristine, and God's beauty is all around you, however you want to call it God, you can't look at that and go, okay, yeah, this just happened out of nowhere. Hey, and this is a rabbit hole that I've traveled before, and you've certainly heard it, I'm sure. Yeah, but there's the Big Bang. Okay, well, who created the spark that created the bang is what I always want to say. And I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about this higher manifestation of power that has created what we see. But, yet I digress.
Well, one thing that is interesting to consider is, and this is a point of science, that we're living in an anthropic universe, a universe that allows life to exist. The chances of that require all of Planck's minimums and all of these other conditions of physics to be exactly what they are. If they vary by a tenth, a thousandth of a percent, the universe wouldn't support life. And some people have come up with a number to represent the likelihood of this, and it's 10 to the power of 120. If you were to write that out in normal notation, like 1000, you would need thousands of years to write it out. And then when you'd written it on paper, it would fill about a third of the known universe. That's how unlikely it is that life could be existent in the universe. And so that humbles you if you're willing to be humbled. And it is kind of a fascinating fact.
Well, I'm going to have you back on the show at another time to where we can drill down to those. Your voice will be rested. You'll be in your new house and we'll have a little bit of time. I might even just drive up to your neighborhood and sit down and do it in person, because I would do that in a heartbeat. Because
where are you?
I'm in San Diego, Encinitas proper. Yeah.
Oh, then we could get letter together for lunch or something.
I would love that, because I have a feeling you and I could go down that rabbit hole, because, and I'm going to tell you when we wrap here in a few minutes, that idea, just a little germ of an idea, and because I'm curious to see if that was your intention or if I'm just hallucinating and or insane. So that's going to be one of those things. All right. Before, as we begin to wrap up, before we get to rapid fire questions, which is a fun little quick, very quick game, I want to ask, I always ask my visiting authors who offer their best piece of advice. And along that line, I found an article that lists your top 7 tips for penning a masterpiece. One of my favorite things I've read yet, and there's a few things that you covered in it that is in this article, and I'm not actually going to go through it right now. I'm going to offer it in the notes on my show so that we can keep moving along. But so I'm not going to do that now, but we want to share, if you were to give a best piece of advice to aspiring writers, and I know you probably got 50, what would that best, it could be 2 or 3. What would that advice be?
Well, first of all, I hope that article wasn't, I don't recognize that article. So if it was going back too many years, I might not agree with all the 7 points. But if it's something more recent, probably is. I would say it comes back to that thing, write what you're passionate about. And don't do a lot of thinking about what do they want. Then another thing I would also say is, if your passion is to write, I don't know, let's say Westerns or romances or thrillers or science fiction novels, whatever your passion is, don't read just that. As a reader, broaden out and read all kinds of things, because the broadening of your reading is liable to change what you're most passionate about. But it's also, if it doesn't, and you still say, this is what I'm most passionate about, all those other genres that you've read in now, and I consider literary fiction another genre. Once you've done all that expansive reading, what you're going to find is you've run into techniques and all kind of interesting sort of tricks that writers have that you're not always going to find in that genre you're passionate about, that once you've seen them, once you've learned them, you can bring and start to create something new within that genre. That's where you're going to succeed. So those are probably the 2 strongest pieces of advice I'd give. And basically just be persistent. You're going to have naysayers your entire career, and you just can't listen. The world is full of naysayers. You have to listen to good advice. You have to listen when an editor says, gee, I think you need another page to on this character because didn't quite get what it was trying to achieve here. And you look at it, you can say, that's right, I'll give you that extra page or two. Because if you do take a few things the editor says that have come across, sometimes you say no, sometimes you say yes. If you've taken various things and you've inserted them in the book, when it's published, it doesn't say by Dean Kuntz with excellent suggestions by. So you get all the credit, so why not do it? But I have known writers who get adamant about saying no to everything. And I think that's a mistake. So yeah, that's probably my greatest amount of wisdom.
Superb, superb. And it makes me think there's a, who's the guy who wrote Steal Like an Artist? The point being this, everyone thinks that, oh, well, you can't write that because it's not completely original and or it's been done forever. However, you can read someone, like you just said, there's a device I read by a gentleman named Chris Hoddy that recently, and I told him straight up, I'm like, dude, that thing that you do right here, I'm going to steal that. I'm just going to tell you straight up, I'm going to steal it. I'm not going to plagiarize your work, which would be copying it, but I'm going to steal the idea, the device. And he goes, hey, wait a minute. I'm like, but isn't that what we do? And he goes, yeah, you're right. So that's a great, great point.
We stand on the shoulders of generations of other writers. So it's almost impossible to create something entirely new. And it comes back again. I've said this, and I think it's true. What you really have to sell is not so much the story, not so much the characters, not so much all of that, those elements of the story. It's your voice. It's the thing about you that is different, and that the way you see the world. And every one of us is unique. So if you give your own personal passion the story, it's not going to sound like anyone else.
Yeah. So good. So good. You know, and it's guys like me who were really just kind of getting started at a later age that look up to guys like you and go, well, I want to learn from the master. So that's why they ask the questions like, where do you get your thoughts? And, and you know, what is your technique? And what is your, I was laughing with my wife this weekend, and she said, well, what are some of the questions you're going to ask Dean? I said, well, I'm not going to ask about where you get your thoughts, and I'm not going to ask him what his routine is. I'm like, I don't know what it is about us writers that want to go, when do you start writing? And when, how long do you go? But maybe it's that we think, Dean, is it that we think that your magic will rub off on us? Or if we copy your method, that we'll be able to create the same magic? What is that?
I was at one point, I think, probably always interested in that kind of thing. Not so much about, I get asked a lot, what is the office like you work in? And I think, I just was answering that question. And my publisher sends me social media posts. They need to get, I write them because I don't like other people writing stuff for me. And then they also send reader questions. And one of them is, what is the office like you work in? What does it look like? And so forth. And I don't know why that fascinates. And so when I answered it, I said, the previous house, I worked in an office with a spectacular ocean view. I had the window shades down all day long. I never saw that ocean view for 20 years because if I had the shades up, I'd sit and stare at it. Now I'm in not with an ocean view. I'm in a very large room for my office. It's full of Art Deco furniture and Art Deco sculpture and ancient Chinese ceramics, actually dogs, fired clay dogs. But what does it matter? Because the same thing applies. I have windows all around this office of a guy with gardens, and the blinds are always down. So in the end, it's not about the furniture. It's what goes on in here.
Right. And before we do rapid fire questions, I do have to ask you this. Are you still using, and I'm going back to that CBS special, are you still using the computer, that same one?
No.
Okay.
I upgraded quite somewhat after that because that was an embarrassing moment. The crew from CBS was at the house for 3 days to do that piece, and they never went in my office until the third day. We were elsewhere doing it. Anthony Mason was the interviewer. He's a very nice man, very good interviewer. And we walked into my office for the first time with the camera running, and he saw the computer and he said, "What the hell is that?" And I told him, you're just lucky it isn't a gas-powered typewriter. because I just got locked into the idea that I didn't want to learn new software by changing computer because that would slow me down. I changed and it was okay. I had a little bit of software.
I'm going to move very quickly here. Last three things, and then we're on our way. Rapid fire questions. You're a prolific writer. You've been a school teacher. But if you could do it all over again, what would you do or be?
I wouldn't change anything. It's been an amazing life. And it's had its ups and downs. It's successes and failures, tragedies and all of that. But that's every life is that way. And there's been a lot of successes here to make up for the other. So I'm just grateful I would go through it all again.
That's awesome. I can't think of a better answer. All right, question number two. My wife, Tammy, and I have invited you and Gerda to join us for dinner. And all that we ask is you bring two extra guests to round out our party for a very delightful evening of conversation. And that's not to say you wouldn't be riveting in and of yourself, but it's part of the contest, the game here. So you're going to bring two people. Who would those two people be, living or dead, and why?
Well, first of all, I would have to bring her dog. She's a golden retriever, and she's a wonderful dog, but she is uber affectionate And she doesn't like to be left at home alone while we go to dinner. So we only go out to dinner at restaurants where we can take her with us. So you would be obliged to have the dog. Then I would probably bring Flannery O'Connor, because she wrote some of the best short stories I've ever read, and the scariest short story I think ever written, which is A Good Man is Hard to Find. At the end of that story, I've read it 20 times, and it chills me to the bone every time. So who else in addition to that? Let's see, probably the comedian Stephen Wright. I don't know if you know Stephen Wright.
I love him, yeah.
He is the most amazing comic mind, because his jokes are unlike anybody else's. And the moment you hear it, you think how obvious the thought was and how hilarious it is. So it would be interesting to bring those people together with you and your wife and my dog. My dog would throw into the conversation some comments too, I'm sure.
I'm sure, and I would love that. And my my Carolina dog, Dexter, would get along fine. Two great guests. That would be an exceptional evening. All right, and number three, final question. This resembles something we said earlier, but it's slightly different. You've been asked to return to Shippensburg State College to speak to your alma mater's graduating class. Slightly different again. Writing advice. What's the best piece of life advice? Is there a different piece of life advice that you'd give those young minds before they went out to face the world?
You may know this, that may be why you asked, but many years ago, 25, 30 years ago, maybe more, I was invited to go back to my alma mater and receive an honorary doctorate degree. And it so happened my wife and I were going back to Pennsylvania for other reasons around that same time. So I accepted. And I speak extemporaneously. I don't write notes and stuff. And we drove across country, and my wife kept saying all the way, "Are you working on that speech?" Because she was afraid she was going to be mortified when I got there. And I said, "No, it'll go fine. It'll be fine." And we got there, and then the strangest thing happened. I had in my head the idea it was probably a half hour. And before we went on the stage, she said, "No, it's a 10-minute speech." And I thought, wow, that's quite a short speech for a graduation. And it was completely extemporaneous, but there was one bit of advice I gave them that I think is one of the best pieces of advice I've ever given. I told this class, I think it was a couple of thousand kids in this place, and I warned them that the most important thing in life is never pick a fight with a man who has the words "born to die" tattooed on his forehead. And that I still think is probably the best piece of advice I can get. And one of the things that was great about that was I came home, and a professor of mine from college sent me a picture of taken as I made that remark. And there, all these kids in their caps and gowns had their heads back like this and they're laughing. And I thought, that's not the kind of thing they were expecting today, and neither was the rest of the speech. So
that's perfect.
I also told them that every graduating commencement speaker will tell the audience, "The world needs you, wants you, and they're eager for you to be there." I'm telling you that they don't want you. They're not eager, and you're going to have to fight like hell to make anything of your life. And that was my other bit of advice.
Reality sometimes hurts, right? Well, folks, to learn more, visit deankuntz.com and follow him on Twitter at deankuntz, and like I do, at Instagram at deankuntzofficial. Dean, this has been beyond delightful. I thank you so much for your time.
Well, you've been great. So we'll have to do this and have to get lunch. And do you have my email? If not, once we conclude this, I'll give it to you.
I will do that. And this has just been superlatively delightful. And as we say goodbye, I'm going to jump off and tell you what that idea was. So thank you again for your time.
Okay. Thank you. It was a great interview.
Oh, yeah. Dean Kuntz on the Thriller Zone. Did you enjoy that as much as I did? Pinch me. Yeah. This was a highlight of the year. And what a way to kick off, not literally kick off, but part of season 3 of The Thriller Zone. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show where you could win a copy of The Big Dark Sky. I have two hard copies of The Big Dark Sky behind me on the shelf, and I want to award them to a lucky listener. So here's all you have to do. Go to thethrillerzone.com or drop us an email at thethrillerzone@gmail.com. Now, the reason I give you two different opportunities is you can go to the website and see what we're all about in case you have never been to our website. I mean, you're listening to us on some podcast channel, either Apple or Spotify or Stitcher or iHeartRadio or Google or Amazon, right? But you can also get all of that same beauty right there on thethrillerzone.com. So come see us, meet us, youtube.com/thethrillerzone, of course. That's where our videos live. Soon, videos coming to Apple Podcasts. Check that out. So here's what you do. Let's make it easy. Go to thethrillerzone@gmail.com. In the subject line, say, I want Dean Kuntz's book. Then in the body of the email, tell me where you're listening. Chicago, it could be Los Angeles, it could be Boise, it could be Australia. Just tell me where you are listening to The Thriller Zone. Here's why I would like that book. Easy. Write it in. I'll add all the names. I'll put them on a little piece of paper. I'll stick them in a fishbowl, pull out a name. Boom. Easy peasy. Now, if you were to ask my wife, what's David's favorite movie? It's either going to be anything James Bond or anything Jason Bourne. Pretty much. Now, yeah, I do Godfather among my favorites. Heat. I'm not going to go down that road because there are too many to list. But Jason Bourne. All right. So next week, Brian Freeman. He has written a book called The Bourne Sacrifice, part of the Robert Ludlum series, right? Brian Freeman, Jason Bourne, Bourne Sacrifice. I can tell you right now, easily, on my top 10 books of the summer. I kid you not. He's on the show next week. Dean Kuntz and now Brian Freeman. It makes you say, who's going to be next? Folks, I got to get on out of here. Thank you again. I'm your host, David Temple. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for subscribing to our YouTube channel. Thank you for those 5-star reviews that you've been writing for us. You can do it on our website or you can see it, do it on any one of your podcast channels. Thank you so much. It's people like you that make my job so easy and so much fun. Thank you to my sponsors who have believed in the show from the beginning. You know who you are. Thank you so much. So until next time, which is going to be what?
The Bourne Sacrifice.
Thanks again to Dean Kuntz. Made my whole week. I'll see you next time for another edition of The Thriller Zone.